This episode is brought to you by Yotta Energy. That's Yotta Energy. We all know energy storage is key to deploying renewables at scale. I've seen many energy storage solutions for commercial buildings over my years in climate tech, but not as impressive as Yotta's. Yotta Energy's PV-coupled ecosystem of solar plus storage solutions simply integrates within the standard solar installation process. Even better, their integrated storage technology can enable up to 60% more solar to be deployed on commercial buildings. With commercial buildings consuming 35% of electricity, that means Yotta is making a serious dent in CO2 emissions. With the electrification of everything revolution underway, Yotta Energy is poised to meet the growing demands of electrification by sizing solar plus storage resources to recharge electric vehicles as they future-proof buildings into distributed energy sites powering the grid of the future. Find out more at yottaenergy.com and follow Yotta on Twitter at Yotta Energy. This episode is also brought to you by Aether Diamonds. That's A-E-T-H-E-R Diamonds. If you're planning to propose or purchase a timeless gift for your partner, I couldn't think of a better purchase than Aether Diamonds. Aether Diamonds are the world's most sustainable diamonds and the only diamonds that are actually good for the planet. Aether creates the world's first positive impact diamonds made from captured CO2. In fact, every carat of Aether Diamonds offsets your personal carbon footprint for over a year. These are 100% real diamonds with a real impact. They're some of the highest quality diamonds you can buy and are certified by IGI, the world's largest independent laboratory for testing and grading gemstones and fine jewelry. Now you're no longer stuck having to choose between mined and regular lab-grown diamonds, both of which harm the environment. Aether offers the only truly sustainable diamonds on the market, requiring no ethical or environmental trade-offs. In other words, they're the only guilt-free diamonds available in the world. To learn more about these revolutionary diamonds from Aether, visit their website at aetherdiamonds.com and follow on Twitter at Aether Diamonds. Hello, my fellow climate warriors. This is Matt Myers, and welcome to another episode of Climate Tech Cocktails, where we grab a drink or two with best-in-class climate tech founders to learn from their life journeys, dive into bleeding-edge technologies, and have a laugh while we're at it. My guest today is Itasha Cave, co-founder and chief science officer of 12. You can find 12 on Twitter at 12_CO2. Itasha became passionate about energy and climate change while growing up in Houston, Texas, and she went on to receive her PhD from Stanford University, focusing on electrochemical approaches that could be used to convert CO2 and water into useful plastics and household cleaners. While at Stanford, Itasha co-founded 12, a startup pioneering a new market category called carbon transformation with its proprietary catalyst technology that transforms CO2 into critical chemicals, materials, and fuels that are conventionally made from fossil fuels. Using 12's technology, industry brands can meet emissions targets faster while creating essential products, from the foam and running shoes to the polymers in automobile dashboards, to aviation fuel, to laundry detergent, all while maintaining the same or higher quality as conventional products made from petrochemicals. Without further ado, enjoy the show. Itasha Cave, welcome to the show.
Hi, Matt. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. And so what are we drinking this afternoon, early evening?
Well, my favorite cocktail of all time is the gin and tonic. Tonic has one of the few things in our world that has a strong bitter taste to it. And bitter is one of our kind of, you know, five core tastes and often gets neglected. So I really love that part of it. Coffee is another really big part of our world that also has a bitter taste to it.
Do you drink lots of coffee?
I drink lots of coffee as well.
Yeah, so do I. I literally just downed some coffee before this conversation. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah, coffee before a G&T.
Yeah.
Which is classic. I love going back to a gin and tonic using Tanqueray, though I usually use Hendrix gin. And I've got the, I don't know if you tried this Fever Tree tonic water.
I have. I love it. Yeah, it's one of my favorite brands.
Stuff's really good. And then I've got Nelly and Joe's famous Key West lime juice.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Got to get a little lime in there.
Yeah, totally. Well, this reminds me of when we first met. I don't know if you remember this or not. This was back in Austin.
Yeah, the Fortune Conference.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The Fortune Conference, you pitched on stage. Of course, you crushed it and won. and we were in the hotel bar. What was it? I think it was the Four Seasons Hotel. Yeah,
some fancy, really posh.
Yeah. Bar. Yeah, we were at some fancy bar, and then this fancy guy, I think he said he was a prince, who...
That's right, yeah.
who had a residence in the hotel, and he bought us, or he didn't buy us, but he just bought a bottle of champagne, and he left it there. And he was like, you guys enjoy.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not one to turn down free drink. That's one thing I picked up from my grad school days. You know, just you find free food or free drinks, and you're like, oh.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like free champagne here, enjoy. And then we were, you know, toasting to your victory with champagne from some odd prince who probably was oil money, is my guess. But
you know. Oh, you think so? Because I think like that he was like some royal family in one of the Eastern European countries. I mean, they just have like old money. It's just like heritage. Yeah, they get like,
oh, so you really had a conversation with this guy.
Yeah, yeah, because he was looking to get into clean tech investing.
Oh,
so I had a follow-up conversation with him, but oh, cool. Didn't go that much further.
Oh, okay, so he didn't invest.
No, I mean, and it just at the time, like the structure that he was trying to put together was like a bit different than what we had seen, and we weren't really technically raising money at that time. We were what was called Cyclotron Row, now it's called Activate. And, you know, we were like, you know, bootstrapping and kind of scraping by, but we were doing that for a moment to kind of make sure we can get the prototype together and get everything working before we started taking on private funding. So just like, just didn't work out.
Well, if he's listening to this, sorry, bud, you missed your opportunity.
But it's okay. I mean, it's like if you're a prince of a country, you got lots of opportunities coming your way. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, it's always a pleasure to have a fellow Texan on the podcast.
Yeah, that's right. I grew up in Houston. And yeah, it's lovely. Houston's a lovely place. Although yeah, I did not want to stay there. After I graduated from high school, I wanted to get out there as quickly as possible. But my heart is still in Texas.
Yeah, I hear you. I wanted to get out of Dallas as quickly as possible, too.
Yeah.
And looks like we both did. I guess that's what took you to Antarctica. You went to Antarctica and I went to China. It was like, get me far away from here. Yeah. I was actually just back in Texas for South by Southwest.
Oh, no way. I was there too, actually. I was doing a National Science Foundation panel.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. This is one thing that I wish the government would do more of, is really kind of brag about themselves. I mean, the National Science Foundation supports early stage technical companies at a, mm-hmm. you know, almost idea generation stage. And they were basically doing this panel at South by Southwest to attract more people to apply for their Small Business Innovation Research Grant. So yeah. They had a few of us on a panel. I wasn't able to stay very long, so that's why we probably didn't run into each other. But yeah, I was there for a few days.
Oh, cool. Did 12 or Opus 12 at the time receive SBIR money?
Yes. Yeah. We received SBIR money from National Science Foundation, from NASA, Department of Energy, and Air Force had like a SBIR grant or contract they had.
Awesome. Yeah. I just actually released the Kevin Martin episode today from Unspun, and he was talking about how they wouldn't exist without SBIR funding.
Yeah, I mean, same for us. Like we, you know, the way that SBIR funding is structured is that you get funding to do a proof of concept, and then you take that proof of concept, you know, if you meet your milestones, and you go on to do a prototype and scale up the system. And most of the agencies actually are technology specific, like NASA cares about technology that supports space and Earth, or, you know, their broad mission of like planet protection and kind of space exploration. Department of Energy cares about promoting energy security, as well as reducing kind of greenhouse gas emissions. And, you know, Department of Transportation, of course, transportation stuff. NIST is for about instrumentation standards and the like. And so most of them have like this very technology specific grants, but National Science Foundation is relatively technology agnostic. They will fund anything except for drug discovery because it National Institute of Health does so much of that. And they have a lot of SBIR programs as well in the NIH. So I try to encourage anyone who's doing a kind of technology transfer from the university out into industry to look at the SBIR program as an early stage investment in that technology and in you and your company.
Well, I'm sure the commercialization people at NSF are going to love this conversation. In addition to the one with Kevin Martin as well. Was it difficult for you to figure out how to apply for an SBIR grant? It's okay to be honest.
I mean, there was a steep learning curve at the time. They've pretty much revamped the program. And now you do like a 1 or 2 page pitch and then you get the go, you get like encouraged to do the full proposal. And they do a pretty good job of outlining what they want in the proposal. But it did take us like 3 tries before we got accepted. But you did get reviewer comments back and you can update your proposal, you know, based on like the reviewer comments to make it stronger. Like the first set of comments were around like our proposal sounded more like a science experiment than a company. And just the way we had written it made it seem like we were still doing research in a lab in a university, which...
Well, it's not true.
Yeah, I guess in some ways it's true, but it's applied research. They want to support applied research, not like more fundamental stuff.
Yeah.
And I think we just had to learn the, you know, we're no longer in grad school. So like it's, right. You know, it is more applied and showing how we would actually work and develop metrics that would build a product. And so we revamped our proposal and were awarded. And it was great. A lot of support and really nice to have that funding.
Awesome. Well, let's take 2 steps back. And by the way, we don't have to go through the, you know, where you grew up and all that, because if people want to hear that, there's already, you know, a great podcast that you did with Emily Kirsch, What It Takes, which I think does a really great job of, you know, discussing your childhood and so people should go check that out as well. But, you know, I think it is still, you know, very briefly, like pertinent where like geographically you did grow up. And I'm curious, you know, just to sort of set the stage, how did that influence you to go into climate, or did it?
Yeah. I mean, I think I'd be hard pressed to say that it did not. I mean, I think kind of seeing the effects of the way we were getting our energy and just really knowing how important it is. I mean, I grew up in Houston. It is an energy town. And, you know, I was very keenly aware of like the role that, you know, drilling for oil and gas played in our city and then our civilization, really. I mean, it still does. I mean, like it's, yeah. I think there's just a matter of scale that petroleum has been able to reach that it's just very, very ubiquitous right now. And so, and at the same time, like while I, you know, had this understanding and of the role of oil and gas, I also could see what would happen if you didn't deal with the waste from oil and gas processes and even really just any process. If you have waste that is detrimental to kind of mixing within a human environment, mm-hmm. that can just not be good. And so kind of really wanting to create a world in which we had abundance. I mean, I think we all want an abundant world and energy underpins that. And so how can we still create energy and still deal with our waste and not have to have a world in which we have kind of the negative effects of waste and can create circular economies and can, you know, create clean energy sources and so on.
Oh, sorry. Interrupt, but I just want to like, narrowing a little bit, what kind of waste are we talking about?
Well, specifically the waste that I became aware of when I was much younger was there was a abandoned oil and gas waste site that was in an adjacent neighborhood to mine. And that waste had like leached into the water supply. But I think we look at CO2 emissions that are thrown away into the atmosphere as waste. Mm-hmm. And it's really just anything that you're, you know, a resource that you're putting somewhere where it's not useful or is causing a negative externality, I would consider that to be waste. So CO2 certainly fits that bill.
CO2 does, and then what other forms of waste are we talking about?
Yeah, there's, broadly speaking, in industry, there's, you know, you hear about waste ending up in water streams and waste ending up in, you know, being buried improperly in unsealed containers. There's even, you know, agricultural waste that you can utilize and, like, you know, repurpose, but if you also don't have to. And so there's that. So I'm just broadly speaking, like, any resource that's being thrown away, so to say, or not being utilized could be considered waste.
Right. And something to think about too, which when we get into 12 and what you all do, which would become abundantly clear, like, you know, a lot of the focus is on CO2, but there's all these other positive externalities that we could also talk about with the waste that's being avoided by not using petrochemicals for certain inputs for products, right?
Yeah, presumably. I mean, I don't know the inner details of kind of petrochemical refinements, but I do know that, you know, with our process, we basically are trying to provide another pathway for making the same products you can make currently in the petrochemical world, you could make from CO2, from CO2 waste. And so you're kind of providing a pathway for that waste to become useful.
Right. Absolutely. So grew up in Houston and being literally exposed to these industries clearly influenced you and motivated you.
Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate, seeing that all that development around me and being in the refineries and also being near NASA, you know, NASA Johnson Space Center is not too far. It's technically in Houston, but it is kind of on the outskirts. And I, my neighborhood and where I grew up is about a 20-30 minute drive from NASA.
Right. And so then this, I guess, inspired you, influenced you when you chose what to focus on with your graduate studies.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Yeah. And so what did you focus on in your graduate studies?
Yeah, when I was in grad school, I really came in with a strong sense of purpose. I think sometimes grad students come in with a strong, like, sense of technology or problem they want to work on. But I had more of a sense of purpose, and I wanted to work on something in clean energy or some way to, like, deal with waste. And so when I was reading through the different professor descriptions of what they would be doing research on, I came across Thomas Jaramillo, who became my advisor, and he was looking at mimicking biological processes, but specifically what trees do. So trees take in carbon dioxide from the air and water from the ground and will use sunlight as an energy source to convert that CO2 into sugars. And he was sort of asking the question, like, can we kind of mimic that process, but in an industrial setting, and use metal catalyst with electricity as a form of energy, but still taking in CO2 and water and make molecules that would be useful for industry. And so joining his lab with my now co-founder, Kendra, she had started a year before I did, we started working on this, and we were looking at the basic science side of metal catalyst and how you can engineer them to become more selective for converting CO2 into a specific molecule. And so we worked on that during our PhD and graduate work. And it was really toward the end of that when we realized, like, hey, maybe we have something here that's ready to be scaled up and brought into industry. And so we sort of started down that path.
Yeah. And I mean, was there a light bulb moment when that happened, when you realized, oh, this could be more than research, this could be a business?
I think there's, like, a series of moments. I would say our first big time in which we were like, okay, this could happen, is when we got into the program that's now called Activate, but the site at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, I guess, is still called Cyclotron Road. And it was called Cyclotron Road back then. We got into this program. It's a fellowship program where we were able to have, you know, salary support. Especially for someone like myself, I had no money. I was like, you know, I say this in the What It Takes, but I was like living out of my car at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. I can say that now because I'm not doing it anymore. But yeah, I mean, I basically was like, well, this is a gated area. And like, I could just, I was working late anyway, so I started just like spending the night there. So I just ended up.
No, really, really. So that it's kind of like some like all those stories about, oh, Jim Carrey sleeping out of his car so that he could be an actor, and you're sleeping out of your car so that, you know, you could help create a solution for climate change, right?
Yeah. Yes. Essentially.
Was it a nice car? I mean, was it big? Was this large? Like, it was like an SUV or a VW like hippie van? Or
no, it was a Honda Fit.
A Honda Fit.
That's the thing. Like you look at a Honda Fit, you don't think, oh, someone's sleeping in there.
Yeah.
There's a ton of room because you can put the seats down. And I'm pretty small. I mean, I'm like 5'4". So I could sleep like diagonally and have enough space. And it was great.
How long were you living in the Honda Fit? That is a small car. You're right. Like I couldn't yeah, like think of somebody sleeping in that car.
Yeah. Anyone tall would not be happy in the back. Yeah. I mean, it was about a year or so.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Wow. Cool. They were like, oh, wow. Who's this person in the parking lot? And it's like, well, little do you know.
Yeah. I mean, because the thing is, I was working late anyway. And I mean, it just was like, there are people who work late there anyway. So, I mean, it was very much like work, sleep, get up, eat, you know, get up again, eat, and go to work again.
Well, that's a big change from going and living in a car to living, or a Honda Fit of all cars, to living in a community home.
Yeah, it's true. It is a big upgrade. A lot more roommates, housemates.
I'd love to talk about that a little bit because it's a thing. In the Bay Area, I think they also do it in Portland too. Let's say like more hippie oriented cultures, right? The communal living. But can we talk about a little bit about where you live and have lived over the past years since the Honda Fit? Did you name the Honda Fit, by the way? Like, what did you name your car?
I did. Her name's Sita.
Sita. Mm-hmm. Like Casita. Sita.
Yeah, although the Sita I was referring to, there's like, it's a, she's an Indian goddess.
Oh, okay. That makes that better.
Yeah, she was very powerful.
Oh, awesome. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, for now I live in this community house where there's like 14 of us. It's called The Radish, and it's a really great atmosphere. And it's, you know, we have our own space. Like, so there's like apartments, and then there's, you know, individual rooms, and we have a communal kitchen and a communal living area. Mm-hmm. And I just really enjoy the communal aspect, but still can have my privacy and be in my own space. And I think what really put me on this like communal living train, I guess, was being in Antarctica and being in this big community. And then grad school and undergrad really are just big communities where you can walk around and see people you want to spend time with. And so when I was leaving grad school, not no longer living on campus, I really wanted to find a way to still have that community vibe. And so in the past like 2.5 years, I've been living here at The Radish. And what I love about it is that, you know, I can, like, high density housing is one way to really reduce one's carbon footprint in mm-hmm. a very passive way. Like, I don't need to think about it. I don't need to actively be like, oh, I, you know, should I do this or that? It's just like, it just is. It's just like a lower carbon footprint because you're cooking larger meals, and so like your, the amount of heat usage per person is much lower. And plus it's just more fun. You know, I just have, you know, people I really enjoy spending time with, and we support each other and just have kind of like a big family.
Why is it called The Radish?
It was named before I joined, and I think it was like an autocorrect fail that someone had, and it was like The Radish, and so it just kind of caught on and people started using it.
So I heard you have a nickname in the house.
Oh yeah, Tosh.
Oh wait, which I heard Bulk Beats was.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, during lockdown, we basically had 14 young adults who all were pretty much working during the day, but we're now kind of, you know, locked down in this single pod. And we had a lot of fun. I had the quarantine time of my life, as I call it, because, you know, when we weren't working and like on the weekends, we were all here. And one of the things we did, we had themed months. So we had a summer camp theme, and we all had camp names. So my name became Bulk Beats because during lockdown, we started having to basically cook all our meals here, whereas previously people were, you know, professionals, young professionals. So we were going to the office and they were eating lunch there and sometimes eating dinner there. And so now we had to buy all this food to like have three meals per day for 14, sometimes 16 people, because sometimes we'd have people during our pod. And so we started ordering from a restaurant supply company. But the thing with a restaurant supply company is like sometimes even with 14 people, you don't need bulk items.
Right.
And so there was one member of the community who really liked smoothies and would put a beet in the smoothie. And so he requested beets. And I was ordering groceries at the time, so I was in charge of all food ordering. So I was like, oh, well, at this restaurant supply company, they had a sale on beets. So I was like, let me get bulk beets. And so it was like too many beets for everyone at once. And so that became my camp name.
What did you do with all the beets? It's like, did it get to a point where everybody was just tired of beets?
Yeah, pretty much. We made a lot of smoothies with the beets. We made like roasted veggies with them. We did eventually eat them. I mean, they preserve really well. So, you know, you can't go wrong. It's a good, like, you know, for the next pandemic, having some beets around, you can't go wrong, I think.
Yeah, you guys would listen to Beat It while making a beet smoothie.
That's right. We're the radish. So they're like, you know, we're all root vegetables here. We're all about it.
Yeah. I'm just really curious for the summer camp theme. Did you guys have activities that you did like archery in the house?
Yeah. We we had an archery set and we did like arts and crafts one time. And then we did, we watched a movie together, had karaoke. I mean, we were all working at this time as well. So, I mean, this is like in between full-time working. It was like weekends and evenings. But remember, like during lockdown, you could not go anywhere. There was nothing happening for like 2.5-3 months solid, you know, even longer than that. And we were really conservative about COVID. I mean, we were, And none of us, you know, we went nearly 2 years with no one in the community testing positive for COVID. Now this Omicron variant got a few of us. But at that point, we were kind of like not as conservative as we used to be. But no one within the community got the Alpha or Delta variant, which was...
That's amazing. Yeah. And what a better way to pass quarantine than with a community of great people.
For sure. Yeah, it was so fun. That's awesome.
That's awesome. And so what was it like living in Antarctica?
Also a really great community as well. I mean, I think, so yeah, when I was in Antarctica, you're sort of isolated, but you still have 1,000 people there with you. It's a small town in a lot of ways, and it's isolated. Like the only channels we could get on TV, in quotations, was the military channels, which have very prescribed TV shows. So they just have like a roster of things to show.
CBS.
Yeah. They have like a news channel, then they have like a, I don't know, like sitcom channel, and then like another one. And it just like, it's very prescribed. So it's not like you can turn on your TV and just like watch like an array of channels. At least when I was there, it might be a little different now, but
no between two ferns, basically.
Yeah. Yes. And like the Wi-Fi was spotty, and they're basically, like, I don't think there was Wi-Fi. There was only a hard connection, but like you had to be at a certain set of computers, and everyone wanted to use a computer to like check their email and stuff. And so you didn't really have much time to stream anything. But what was great is that, you know, you had your meals prepped for you and your meals times. And so everyone would eat together in the whole town, because there was like an hour and a half for breakfast and like an hour for lunch, or maybe it was an hour and a half for lunch. And, you know, hour and a half maybe for dinner, that the time window you had to go within that time, or you could snack later at night, but there was no like full meal. And so everyone was in the same place at the same time. And then again, like after work, you would go to there was a coffee shop and two bars, and you would just go and spend time with people in this really meaningful way. And so I think that's really where I just realized, like, it's just really amazing to be in a communal setting. It's just awesome. It's better than watching TV, I think.
Yeah. Was there karaoke in any of these bars?
There definitely was karaoke night. We had, in fact, fun story is that we had a karaoke. Well, we had like a, it wasn't called a talent show. It was like a Sideshow or something like that, where it was just like, you could do anything you wanted to perform. So I went up and did lip syncing with Sasha Tina Turner. and it was kind of, there was a bit of a competition. So I ended up winning the competition, like the audience award.
Oh, wow.
And then later on, we would do like just karaoke nights, which would be much smaller events. And they had like organized like trivia nights. And there was a rugby match between the New Zealand station, which was within walking distance of our station. And that was fun. So we had like station-wide events, but then also just small group gatherings and hanging out with people.
Did you get an actual award that you like keep on your mantle from this?
You do, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you complete your season, your contract, you get a U.S. Antarctic Medal of Service. It's like the only, I believe it's the only military award that a civilian can earn, or maybe it's the highest one that a civilian can earn, something like that. Yeah, because the Antarctic Station used to be, in fact, well, I should probably Google that before I lost it around the world, but I'm pretty sure that's the case. But the base used to be, the station used to be run and owned by the Navy. And so that is the linkage of why you get this award. It's a congressional award.
Why'd you go there in the first place? Like, where did you want to go there, or you were asked to go there for to do research? Like, why'd you go?
Oh, I wanted to go. I mean, I just finished my undergrad education and knew I wanted to do grad school, but needed some time to kind of explore the world and see what's out there a little bit. And plus I also, at that time, you know, I was like, okay, if I wasn't going to be an entrepreneur, I was like looking at astronaut as like the second option.
Interesting.
Or I mean, I still would have to be an astronaut later in life, but it was also something that's on my radar. And so Antarctica was like training ground for some astronauts who got to go out there and kind of experience what it's like to be in isolation, to be in an extreme environment, to kind of rely on others. So that was also part of it. And it's just like adventurous and fun. And
oh, cool. I didn't realize that. And are there a lot of penguins like just waddling around?
They're not just like hanging out in the town. but they do occasionally, at least my season, they came into town and you could see them. And then they would also do these like organized, like they call them boondoggles, where, you know, periodically to kind of keep the morale of the station up, you could go to these spots where there were a higher chance of seeing penguins.
Yeah.
And so we would do that, and we saw some along the way.
Yeah. And I mean, speaking of Antarctica, my friend was actually recently out there leading a group, and she was there when it was the hottest day on record in Antarctica. Mm-hmm. I think it was, I just looked it up before this to confirm the date, but it was March 18th and it was 70 degrees above normal.
Wow.
Yeah. Which is kind of crazy. It puts things into perspective, right?
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, she went within the past year.
Oh, this was this March. So this was like 2 weeks ago.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, I know. Pretty crazy. Which kind of brings us to the joys of climate change and what you all are doing. And actually, I just noticed on your website, which is very beautiful, by the way, I love the revamp and I love the video that you all have on your website. I was watching it before this session and honestly, tears were coming to my eyes because of the IPCC report that came out, I think it was today or yesterday, and then which is just, you know, really distressing. And then I saw the video and I was like, oh, there is hope.
Isn't that great? That's the outcome we want, is for people to feel like there is hope. Because in my mind, it's like, if you don't have hope and think that things can change and no one will do anything about it. And so it's like, if there's something we can do.
Yeah. And you all are doing a lot about it. And it's awesome to see just how much 12 is working on. That's also being displayed on, you know, on your website. And so I just like to talk a little bit about maybe like the elevator pitch of what 12 does. And then I'm also really interested in the last, I guess I could say, year and a half of progress that you all have made as a company?
Yeah, so 12 is a carbon transformation company. We are looking to convert carbon dioxide into usable products through a process we call industrial photosynthesis, where we have these, we call them like a black leaf, which is our core electrode, that can convert carbon dioxide into new products.
Yeah. And what does this look like? Because I remember when you all were going around pitching, you know, 2 years, it had to be 3 or 4 years ago, right? Because COVID's 2 years. So you guys were walking around with almost like a suitcase, right? In pitching with a suitcase. And so what does this look like?
Yeah, our first system looks like a dishwasher and it's about the size of a dishwasher. We've used that to make new products out of CO2. So we've made some jet fuel. We've made lenses and sunglasses with Pangaea. And we've made an internal part of a car with Daimler. And then we made a component in Procter & Gamble. And so we use that system to make those products. And now we're scaling up that system to something that would fit into a shipping container.
Okay.
And so you can imagine a shipping container near a, say, like a point source emission of CO2. So like when you manufacture cement or steel manufacturing, you inherently make CO2 in that process. And so you can pipe that CO2 through our system and use it to make jet fuel for your next flight instead of having to dig up a new set of, you know, petroleum jet fuel to fly a 200-passenger plane.
Okay, and how does it work?
Yeah, basically, the metal catalyst with electricity, it basically electrocutes the CO2 and water molecule and breaks it down to smaller atomic bits. And then those atomic bits reform into new molecules. And those new molecules can go on to become the jet fuel or the polymer or whatever we're making. So it is a chemical process that uses electricity as an energy source.
Right. And you can produce that energy with renewables.
Right.
Right. And this is also for my own curiosity. I'm just going to be honest. Like, can you describe a bit more of what a catalyst is? How does it work? Because this word's thrown around a lot, like catalyze it and a catalyst. And I only state it like I know what I'm talking about. But just to be honest, I would really love even like a 2 to 3 minute explanation of catalysts. And I'm taking advantage of the situation just because of how smart you are. And I'm like, oh, awesome. I get I get the, you know, the CSO of 12 to explain what a catalyst is. But I think it would also help a lot of people listening to truly understand what it is and how it works.
Yeah. I mean, so catalysts, you know, make the world go round, like all, like within our bodies and within plants and just like a lot of industrial processes use catalysts to basically speed up a reaction. So in a plant, for example, or say even within our own, let's say within our own bodies, we have catalysts which are in the form of a protein. That protein will say bind one molecule to that protein and then change it into a new molecule, and that new molecule will come off that protein as a new, those entirely new species. So I mean, there's, you know, plants, of course, do the same thing with photosynthesis. They have catalysts that speed up their reaction. If you didn't have these catalysts, these reactions would go very, very slow. And so your tree would grow slower. You would grow slower. Industrial processes would be much more slower. We wouldn't be able to produce metric tons or millions of tons of a product without a catalyst that can speed up the reaction.
Okay. So essentially a catalyst, well, you go to the word catalyze, but it's really something that will speed up a chemical reaction. Mm-hmm. And that could be anything that speeds up a reaction.
Yeah. I mean, there's other things about it too. Like it can't be consumed in the reaction itself. Cause if you're consuming it, then, you know, then it's like kind of like it's a reactant, not a catalyst, but catalysts don't get consumed in the reaction. And there's also properties too, where they'll bind the reactants, like the inputs to their site. And then all the change happens at this like site that they bind, and then they come off as a new product. And so there's other things you can say about it, but yeah, fundamentally it's like they speed up a reaction.
And so was one of the, I guess, challenges that you worked on solving with your research, what is the best catalyst or the best catalysts to convert CO2 into something else? Is that what really you all focused on?
Yeah. I mean, we mostly focus on metals, transition metals. And like, you know, we published on what we did, and you can look through literature, you know, Google Scholar, look at CO2 electroreduction and see the types of metals, and you'll see copper, zinc, gold, silver, nickel, you know, all these metals are used to make different products, different molecules from CO2. And you also have to engineer them in different ways. So typically you want to have a really high surface area. So you can get a really high surface area by going to kind of like a nanoparticle size of your catalyst and kind of packing it into, you know, your electrode. So you have these like, you know, nanoparticles on an electrode that have a high surface area. So yeah, so that's basically what we were looking at. But catalysts don't have to be metals. They can be more organic molecules. An organic molecule means a molecule that has like a carbon backbone and can have other types of atoms on it, but fundamentally has a carbon backbone. You can have non-metal molecules that are also catalysts and are not organic. Those don't have carbon, but also don't have metals in them.
Mm-hmm. And so are you able to share which catalysts you all use?
We, you know, broadly speaking, use transition metals in our system.
Okay, got it. And so thank you for explaining that. That makes a lot of sense to me now. And so basically what you guys are doing too is you're using the language carbon transformation, right? Mm-hmm. So you're transforming carbon into something else that has added value to economically, right? So the price comes down. I think it's important to how you all in your literature describe the difference between carbon capture storage, CCS, carbon capture utilization, CCU, and carbon transformation. Could you also, just for those who don't want to go read like TLDR, what's the difference between the three and why is it important?
Yeah, sequestration is when you bury it underground, you know, in an aquifer or something of that sort, like very far down the ground, the way maybe like an abandoned oil and gas drilling site, you could store CO2 there. And that would be sequestration. Utilization is typically where you just utilize the CO2 as a molecule itself. So dry ice, for example, is utilization. You're just cooling down the CO2 and you can make this dry ice. There's another utilization technique called enhanced oil recovery, where you use CO2 to displace oil and gas out of the ground and pump out the oil and gas. Depending on the conditions of the reservoir, from my understanding, is you can leave the CO2 underground and therefore you're creating like a carbon neutral fuel in that particular case. But that is all utilization. You're not like fundamentally changing the CO2 mm-hmm. molecule. And so what our technology does is we call it transformation, because you're fundamentally changing the CO2 molecule. So CO2 is just one carbon and two oxygens. And we're literally like removing one of the oxygens from that compound, and you know, then you've transformed that CO2 into CO, or you can remove another oxygen and put like four hydrogen atoms and make methane. So we're like rearranging those atoms into a new molecule.
And which molecules are you all focused on now? You mentioned methane. I assume that's one of them. Are you all focusing on other molecules as well?
Well, right now we're basically focused on what's called a synthesis gas, which is a mix of carbon monoxide, and we make a little bit of hydrogen. And carbon monoxide is something you hear about as something you don't want in your home. And it's true, you do not want carbon monoxide in your home, but it's a very useful industrial gas. It can be used to make different types of products, all the way from polymers to jet fuel to diesel fuel, gasoline. All these things can be made from CO with a combination of hydrogen in some cases. And we are basically making this building block. So we see the synthesis gas as a building block for making these other products.
Cool. And you rattled off a few, but you mentioned, which could also be found on the website, which is super cool, jet fuel, sunglasses, which I love. I want to get a pair. and car parts. You know, I also saw a detergent with Tide, which is also super cool. But what's the realm of possibilities here?
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally, we have, because we're taking CO2 and water, in theory, anything you can make with carbon, hydrogen, or oxygen atoms, you can make with that process. So that's the like breadth of what we could do. Now, in reality, you know, with our system, you know, making those building blocks and then using established industrial processes to take those building blocks to a more complex molecule is the way we found to really accelerate our process and get it to market much quicker.
Why is that?
Well, because when you make a more complex molecule, you know, there's a lot of like catalyst discovery needs to happen there. You have to like optimize reaction conditions and so on. And so we've kind of come to the conclusion that there's already some of these industrial processes that have already done that work, and they take syngas as the input and make really complex molecules. So, you know, one like company, for example, that's like kind of up and coming is LonzaTech. They have microbes that digest synthesis gas, and those microbes can then make ethanol or an array of other molecules that are much more complex. And so we're kind of like, you know, why try to like take our process, which is, you know, fairly new in the scheme of technology development, this, you know, electricity derived conversion, you know, why not just focus and like, and make this feedstock for industrial processes instead of like reinventing the whole wheel.
Right. So Jennifer Holmgren is actually on the podcast as well. Oh. And so that ironically, that episode might drop the week before yours. So,
oh, great.
Yeah. So if anybody wants to, you know, hear from, you know, badass women who are working on carbon transformation, here you go. Right. A 1-2 punch.
Indeed.
Also, are you all providing, are you able to say that or not? Are you all providing syngas to them?
We've worked jointly with them on a couple of DOE grants. So those are public, yeah.
Awesome. And so again, like I really love what you all are doing with like, say, hey, it's Tide, right? Your detergents or sunglasses. And so why are you all doing that, like consumer facing products?
Yeah. I mean, I think when we looked at our kind of strategy for getting to market quickly, we looked at previous companies that were in like the green chemical space and saw that there was a huge roadblock in the past when you were a green chemicals company. If you went for a larger, like if your first plant was $100 million plant, you had a really big challenge of getting financing for that. Cause there were a lot of technical risks. And then there was also, you know, well, yeah, there's a lot of technical risks, which a lot of like in bank investors and kind of debt financing don't really like to take on or have a strong history of dealing with technical risk. And so we just saw that, you know, there might be a way to kind of start with like a $10 million plant and then grow from there to a $100 million plant. But by the time we get to that $100 million plant, that's like our nth plant as opposed to our first. So that was kind of our strategy to sort of be able to bring in revenue, like de-risk the technology by having it out in the field in a smaller scale. And so you basically need to do consumer products if you're doing that.
And so is that like before the Series A fundraise, which you all did, or is that you're utilizing that fundraise to do that?
We're using the Series A fundraise to build our kind of first, kind of call it pilot or demonstration plant.
Got it. And I just would love to just kind of dig in slightly into the evolution of the company over the last, year and a half. Like, what did it take to get to the point where you were ready for that financing, and like what had to be put in place, and then, you know, where do you, and you kind of, we just touched upon it, but where do you see it going right now to the next fundraise? And then finally, like, where do you see it going from that next milestone?
Yeah, I mean, we've definitely set out milestones along the way on the business side and the technology development side. So, you know, we scaled up our core technology, which is this membrane electrode assembly. That's where the catalyst is housed. And we scaled that up and showed that we could, you know, replicate the performance at each step. We did these proof of concept products where we showed we can make a carbon-based product that's indistinguishable from its petroleum counterpart, but make it from CO2. And then on the business side, we engaged with several different customers and showed that there was demand for our molecules that would have a lower carbon footprint. And so it was kind of like having those milestones and those, like, demonstrating those set things was really key to getting us to the next stage.
Right. Really key to feeling, you know, you and the investors feeling confident, okay, now we can build our first plant and truly commercialize this. Mm-hmm. Well, and so where are you all at in that process? And I'm just curious, like, what you could speak to, like, what are challenges that you're facing? Like, maybe, I don't know if it's on a science side, if that exists anymore, or like on a business side of going from, you know, proof of concept to building that first commercial plant.
Yeah. I mean, it's both. It's like, you know, you kind of lay out different steps that you need to make. And all along the way, every round of funding, you go to larger size. So for our first plant pilot that we're building, you know, that would be like the shipping container size equivalent that we're building. So we're you know, in plans and development for that now. And on the business side, we're, you know, understanding our customers and what they would need and what mm-hmm. a contract would look like. Yeah, for our products.
Awesome. And what does it look like in 3 years, 2 to 3 years? Like if we're catching up in 2 to 3 years and everything goes to plan, what does 12 look like? I know. It's like, yeah, if everybody goes to plan, yeah, right, Matt. But if it does, then what does it look like?
Yeah, I mean, at that point, we should have scaled up our manufacturing. So we'd have a large manufacturing floor. We'd be making a lot of these membrane electrode assemblies as our core technology. And we'd be deploying systems on the field. So we would have, you know, first sets of plants that we would be deploying and converting CO2, many tons of CO2 per day, into different molecules and different products.
Right. And on your website, it says, hey, we have potential to, well, at max, you know, decrease emissions by 10%. And so I'm just wondering if you have, like, also an honest conversation, given the IPCC report just came out, like, in the scope of the problem which we're facing, like, what are challenges to getting technology like 12s? And look, we need a lot more 12s, right? We need dozens of 12s that are out there, like, you know, mm-hmm. working on even the carbon transformation problem. But like, what are the challenges to get to where we need to be in order for that piece of the pie to actually be solved?
When we talk about 10% of global CO2 emissions, we're focused on the hard to decarbonize sectors. Mm-hmm. So those are like the industrial CO2 emissions. Like, inherently, when you make steel, you emit CO2.
Yeah.
It's the way it's done mostly today. When you make cement, you inherently emit CO2. And so we're saying, like, those emissions account for about 10% of global emissions, and those we want to address. I think the other 90%, we're saying, look, there's other technologies that are addressing them. So, like, for example, electric vehicles. You know, we can make gasoline from CO2, but you can also just make an electric car and make that cheaper. And like, that might be the fastest way to get to reduce the CO2 emissions in the, like, small passenger vehicle sector. So we're just focusing on the hard to decarbonize sector. I mean, once we get that 10%, there's plenty of CO2 to go around. Like, we will not stop at 10% if we've gotten all of it, but that's just kind of our focus point right now.
Well, you know where there's plenty of CO2? Mars.
Yeah.
is that the backup plan?
No, I wouldn't call it a backup plan. I think Mars is a very harsh environment. I would take, you know, Mars is not someplace you want to live. I mean, there's nothing we can do to Earth that would make it a worse place to live than Mars. Nothing. So, but I think Mars is really cool from an exploration point. Mm-hmm. It's just a new planet. It's like, let's go out and explore and discover things. And 95% of the, over 95% of the atmosphere on Mars is CO2. And so you can make methane, which is a rocket fuel of choice for SpaceX to go to Mars and come back. And then you could make these other complex molecules there. So you could have a small civilization that's there while we're also doing that on Earth and using that to reduce this greenhouse gas emissions.
Well, I see you, I noticed on your website, I didn't dig into it too much. They all are doing something related to Mars. Is that just kind of like also to help ultimately you achieve your dream of being an astronaut?
Yes. NASA called me. We had a grant from NASA that was looking to do just that, of like, you know, how to use what they call NC2 resource utilization. So how to use resources that are on a different planet instead of having to ship them from Earth. So that grant was what supported some of our early work. If NASA goes to Mars, we would love to have our system on that rocket ship and have it on Mars to be converting CO2 into something useful. And we're keeping an eye out for it. Like, so, you know, if NASA ever goes, we would love to be considered part of that process. But at the moment, I mean, there's no concrete plans to go to Mars as far as I know. And so we're just developing it for Earth and then someday for Mars.
Yeah. And so it's a really exciting time in quote unquote climate tech. There's tons of money floating around and going towards it. I mean, lots of also people in graduate school, even MBAs, who are clamoring to work in climate tech. So it's a really exciting time. And I would love for your opinion to segue to our next question, which is the three founder startups you love. But I was curious, like, with all this money floating around, where would you love to see it go outside of 12? But, you know, where would you love to see that money go or not go, like in the climate tech, under the climate tech umbrella?
I'm a big fan of these electrification of everything movement, where there are other teams that are using electricity to replace systems that were thermomechanical or basically like didn't have electricity as a core part of their functionality. And there's some of that work in agriculture where they're like electrifying, you know, tractors and other things. And even like electrifying the ability to make fertilizer like at the farm or regionally in the farm. And there's other molecules that are currently made thermochemically that we could make with electricity. I'm a big fan of that general movement.
Awesome. And so on that note too, what are three founders and or startups that you love, and it could be more than three, that you want everybody else to know about?
Okay. One company I think is really cool is called SkyCool. And Eli Goldstein is the founder that I know the most there. And so SkyCool is basically rejecting heat into the sky. So they use radiative cooling is what it's called. And it's pretty cool. You can put these panels on a rooftop and reject heat into the sky. And they were an ARPA-E recipient. Another one is Austin Sindick of AIonix. So his team is looking at leveraging, you know, some of this machine learning and AI, artificial intelligence that's being developed, and use it for material discovery and for clean tech.
By the way, Austin was on the podcast and he said you as for like his top three. And he said, almost quote, it would be a dream someday if I could start a company with Itasha. And so maybe in a, post 12 world, whenever that exists, in a post AIonix world, you two can team up. And I'm like, if I had any money in my bank account, I would just throw it at that.
I will come back on this podcast and say how it all got started here.
Yeah, absolutely. So just keep that in mind, planting a seed.
Yeah, so, I'd also love to start a company with Austin. We used to, we're part of this like energy nerds group. And we would just like brainstorm clean tech ideas. So,
is that still a group? Like, is that still a thing?
I mean, sort of. It got kind of sidetracked a little bit with COVID. You know, you can't really gather. And so, you know, we exist in the ecosystem, but it's not as formalized as it probably would have been if the pandemic hadn't happened.
That sounds like a really fun group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and so other founders too, I would list with Lisa Dyson of Air Proteins, Molly Morris of Mega Materials, and Miranda Wang of Nova Loop.
Awesome. Lisa Dyson was also on the podcast too. So, I mean, we're all the awesome people are here.
Wow. You're just getting them all. That's
I'm getting it all. So also the second question is, what are three books that have greatly influenced the way that you think and approach life?
Yeah, I would say Never Split the Difference, this book by Chris Voss on negotiation. And then How to Win Friends and Influence People, classic one. And then How to Change Your Mind by Michael Pollan. I thought that was a really interesting book.
So here we go.
Nice. I've got,
And then I've got I've got all three of those books. I'm just looking at my bookshelf here, which Never Split the Difference. I think it was mentioned by another guest. Again, people who haven't checked it out should. What a great book on negotiation.
Mm-hmm.
And How to Win Friends and Influence People. There was just somebody who was on the pod too who I recommended that. Also an amazing book. And that's like just really how to build networks and community, which is amazing too. And then, you know, How to Change Your Mind. Love that one by Michael Pollan.
Yeah.
Really, really amazing book. And so I'm going to change this question a little bit. I usually ask, what are any final thoughts you'd like to leave our listeners with? But I'd like to ask, are there any final thoughts you'd like to leave PhD students with?
Yeah, I would say, consider talking with others and seeing if you could get support from the National Science Foundation or from other SBIR, Small Business Innovation Research grants, and give it a shot. It's kind of a golden age right now of entrepreneurship, you know, when you're still youngish and poor and could potentially live out of your car, just go for it.
Highly recommend the Honda Fit. Yes. You know, you're under 6 feet tall.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Itasha, for joining us today. Greatly appreciate it and all that you do. And your time is so valuable. So it really means a lot. And if anybody also, if they want to support 12 in any way, what should they do? What can they do?
Well, be on the lookout for CO2 made products. Yeah, if they want to buy some sunglasses from Pangaea or, you know, Tide detergent that is a lower carbon footprint, please do. Otherwise, I just kind of send us good vibes of company growth. And yeah, we'll figure it out.
Awesome. Well, I'm looking forward to that. My favorite thing to do, laundry, not.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much again for joining us. Greatly appreciate it. And I will hopefully see you soon at some Bay Area networking thing.
Yeah, for sure.
Or, yeah, Climate Nerds.
Climate Nerds.
All right, cheers.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for listening. The resources that we mentioned and everything else we talked about, drink recipes, various people, companies, so on and so forth, will all be linked in the show notes on our Substack at climatetechcocktails.substack.com. If you want to write us, our email address is m@climatetechcocktails.com. And you can follow us on Twitter at @CT_cocktails and on Instagram, #ClimateTechCocktails. You can reach me personally by carrier pigeon or on my LinkedIn /Matthew J. Myers. Until next time, keep the dream alive and do your part to make the world a better place for 100% of humanity. And thanks for tuning in.